down and music blaring so loudly, the bass is actually vibrating your car, whips past everyone on the road's shoulder, and forces his way to the front of the line, acting like he owns the road. Or, imagine this. You're in a meeting at work, and that same pushy colleague starts dominating the conversation again, with his annoyingly loud voice and aggressive attitude, not letting anyone get a word in edgewise. Both of these pushy people are bumptious. Bumptious is a different type of arrogance than supercilious. For bumptious, the focus isn't on scornful disdain, looking down on others like my supercilious maitre d', although bumptious people do think they're better than the rest of us. Instead, bumptious emphasizes the loud and pushy aspects of arrogance. Bumptious is an adjective meaning pushy, offensively or loudly self-assertive, cocky. Bumptious people are overly confident in a loud, rude, annoying way, not someone you want to have over for a drink. So let's put bumptious in context. The bumptious young upstart who swaggered around the town as if he owned it was stunned when he was arrested for mouthing off to a police officer. Now, the American Heritage Dictionary relates that bumptious is perhaps a blend of bump and presumptuous. So to remember bumptious, think of an unruly, troublesome person who is so arrogant and pushy, they will bump you out of the way to cut in line. That's another great visual. So in your vocabulary notebook, circle or highlight the bump in bumptious and write pushy next to it. Draw a picture of a pushy, bumptious person bumping you out of the way next to this word. And remember, stick figures are okay. Okay, for our next target word, hubris, let's go back to Greek mythology. Now, you probably remember the Greek hero Odysseus, who, while trying to return home after the Trojan War, was trapped with his crew on an island in the cave of Polyphemus. Polyphemus was a cyclops, the one-eyed giant who had a fondness for snacking on humans. Now, as you can imagine, Odysseus was highly motivated to escape. He told Polyphemus that his name was No Man. He got the Cyclops drunk on wine, put out Polyphemus's only eye while he was snoring, and then snuck his men out, strapped to the underside of Polyphemus's sheep. All in a day's work for Odysseus. When Polyphemus awoke, the Cyclops cried out to his neighboring giants, "No man is killing me!" And of course, if no man is killing you, then you're okay, and you don't need any help. Pretty crafty thinking ahead on Odysseus's part, huh? But Odysseus got a little too cocky, a little too full of himself, and as he sailed away, he taunted Polyphemus with his real name. Not too bright. So in a rage, Polyphemus asked his father, Poseidon, god of the sea, for revenge. And Poseidon, as Greek gods are wont to do when mortals get a little too high and mighty, a little above our station in life, spent the next 10 years punishing Odysseus for his arrogance by destroying his crew and his fleet. What a price to pay for a small taunt, huh? So Odysseus, like many figures in Greek mythology, was punished for his hubris. Hubris is a noun that means excessive pride or self-confidence, arrogance. The related adjective is hubristic. Someone with hubris has gotten too big for their britches. As the story from the Odyssey indicates, hubris comes from the Greek, where it originally meant presumptuous towards the gods. Now, the Greeks aren't the only ones to believe hubris was a fatal flaw that could lead to a hero's downfall. We've already seen the familiar quote from the Old Testament book of Proverbs. And in Christian ethics, pride is often considered the original and deadliest of the seven deadly or cardinal sins. In John Milton's Paradise Lost, it was Lucifer's pride, his hubris, that caused his downfall. So far in today's lecture, we've explored supercilious, bumptious, and hubris to describe different types of arrogance. Now, when pretentious, uppity people talk, they try and impress you with their lofty, overblown prose. You've heard people talk like this. Political speeches that were so ostentatiously over the top, so inflated, high-sounding, and overly ornate that they made you want to laugh, cry, fall asleep, or even gag. We call this type of inflated speech bombast, our next target word. Bombast is a noun referring to pretentious, pompous, grandiloquent speech or writing. Language that is overblown and florid. Bombastic is the adjective form of bombast. Now, in the 16th century, bombast originally referred to cotton padding and stuffing. So how did we get today's meaning? Well, cotton padding isn't very substantial, and it's used to stuff things, like cushions, that are empty to fill them up. So this original meaning has shifted to words that are used to fill empty speeches or writing, to pad them and fill them up, since there isn't much substance there. Not only is this a great visual mnemonic, but bombast's etymology is a perfect example of how so many words in our language shift from an original, specific, literal meaning, actual padding for empty cushions, to a more general, figurative meaning, words serving as padding or filler for empty speeches. Now, we've already seen this literal to figurative shift in the meanings of words over time, with many other words in this course. So let's put the adjective bombastic in context. The mayoral candidate's bombastic speech turned off the voters, who thought the politician was full of hot air. Now, you'll often see bombastic used alongside its collocates, prose, speech, and writing, in phrases such as a politician's bombastic speech or the author's bombastic prose. Synonyms for bombastic include orotund, verbose, prolix, florid, flowery, and pretentious. Now, orotund comes from the Latin phrase ore tundo, meaning with rounded mouth, and, somewhat paradoxically, has either a positive or a negative connotation, depending on how it's used. Orotund can be a positive when referring to someone's voice, a resonant, booming voice, and a negative when referring to bombastic speech or writing. Now, dictionary.com has a wonderful usage note that discusses the shades of meaning that differentiate verbose, flowery, and pretentious. Use verbose when you want to emphasize that the speech uses more words than what is needed. Another synonym for verbose, overly wordy language, is prolix. Use flowery when you want to emphasize that the language you're describing includes overly ornate images and expressions. And use pretentious when you want to emphasize that the language was intentionally inflated to impress. Our last target word in this excessive pride section is one of my favorites. Bloviate. Bloviate is a verb that means to talk pompously, to talk at great length in a pompous and boastful manner. The talk show host's bloviating turned off so many listeners who couldn't stand his know-it-all attitude that his show was canceled. Now, bloviate is one of those wonderful Americanisms that sound like what they mean. In fact, bloviate is derived from blow, So a blowhard who blows hot air all the time bloviates. And ate, when used as a verb-forming suffix, as in this word, can mean act on. So in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the B-L-O, and next to the word, sketch a stick figure blowing a bunch of hot air. What a great vivid visual etymology connection to help you remember this word. Now, bloviate has an interesting history, waxing and waning in usage over time. According to the wonderful online etymology dictionary, etymonline.com, its first known usage was in the late 1800s, but it was already fading by the turn of the century. However, in the 1920s, it experienced a comeback, being used to describe political speech. Now, this was during the presidency of Warren G. Harding, a man known for his flowery, overblown, difficult-to-understand prose. Of Harding, E.E. Cummings said, now get this one, "The only man, woman, or child who wrote a simple declarative sentence with 7 grammatical errors." So after this, bloviate began to fade again, but staged another comeback, particularly in its noun form, bloviation, during the 2000 election, and is still being used in the press and on blogs to describe politicians and pundits today. So bloviate is a wonderful example of how words can wax and wane in popularity over time. All right, let's play the situation game to review our vocabulary words, our first 5 target words. Supercilious, bumptious, hubris, bombast, and bloviate. Okay, situation 1. You knew Luke as a humble lad, but lost touch when he became an incredibly successful businessman and titan of industry. Now, at this point, Luke lost all humility and required that all and sundry call him Lucas. Hobnobbing with celebrities, politicians, and sports heroes, Lucas became filled with excessive pride. He lost touch with his customers and his employees, leading to his downfall as the company's board of directors replaced him. What do we call the type of pride that led to Luke's downfall? Hubris, his excessive pride. Situation 2. You're watching a political debate on TV, and you think both candidates are arrogant jerks, but different types of arrogant jerks. The first candidate is loudly aggressive and pushy when he speaks, constantly cutting off his opponent and the moderator and consistently going over his allotted time. The second candidate is much quieter and appears to be polite at first. However, you begin to realize from her comments that she looks down on and even scornfully derides those who don't share her social standing, her education, or her wealth. Which candidate is supercilious and which candidate is bumptious? The first candidate is bumptious. He's arrogant in a pushy, loud way. The second candidate, who holds haughty disdain for those not like her, who scorns those that she deems beneath her, is supercilious. All right, situation 3. Halfway through the first lecture on humility in your introduction to ethics course, you conclude that your instructor, Professor Peacock, is a vainglorious, self-important show-off. In the first 30 minutes, he's already name-dropped 3 presidents and the greatest known living philosopher, citing himself twice, and is going on and on using highfalutin, lofty-sounding phrases. And you still haven't learned a darn thing. What's a noun that refers to this type of overblown, inflated language used to fill empty speeches like Professor Peacock's? This word was used to fill empty cushions. Bombast. And what's a verb that describes the pompous way Professor Peacock talks? Blowing hot air. Bloviate. For the second half of the lecture, I'd like to move from pride to its opposite, humility. To be humble is to be modest, not boastful or arrogant, unpretentious. Humble comes from the Latin humilis, meaning lowly, humble, literally on the ground, since humilis is derived from humus, meaning earth. In fact, why do you think we describe humble people as down to earth? And how do we describe their opposite, people who think a lot of themselves, high and mighty, people who are a long way from the earth? However, while humility is a trait that we all admire, we've all encountered people who are falsely modest or who praise others insincerely to get something that they want. Which brings us to our first target word in this category, sycophant. We've all encountered sycophants in our lives. You know the type. It's the suck-up who's constantly flattering her boss to get a promotion. The brown-noser and apple polisher who tells his teacher how much he enjoys her lengthy lectures, her multiple-choice tests, and in particular, how much he just adores her 3-hour essay exams. So a sycophant is a noun referring to a servile, self-seeking flatterer. Sycophants use insincere flattery to curry favor of the wealthy, powerful, and those in positions of authority. Now, we've got some wonderfully vivid synonyms for sycophants, including grovelers, backscratchers, bootlickers, and two of my personal favorites, toadies and lickspittles. You can just imagine these lickspittles licking their lips and rubbing their hands together, bowing and nodding in an ingratiating manner as they spit out false praise. So let's put sycophant in context. When final grades for the course came out, I was furious. All the sycophants who sucked up to the teacher got A's, and the rest of us who actually did the work received no higher than C's. Now, if a sycophant is overly submissive, too eager to please someone in power, then they're being obsequious, our next target word in this category. Obsequious is an adjective that means servile and fawning, overly deferential. Obsequious people show excessive deference to gain favor. They're too much like a servant, and their insincere flattering is meant to score points with those in power. So let's put obsequious in context. After being told he would be fired for one more transgression, the butler immediately became obsequious, complimenting his employer's good looks and fawning over her every word. But the employer saw right through this insincere flattery and fired him anyway. Now, obsequious contains the Latin root usually spelled as S-E-Q-U or S-E-C, meaning follow. Obsequious people follow others to gain their favor. What other related words do you know that contain this S-E-Q-U, S-E-C root? How about sequence as our key word for S-E-Q-U? A sequence refers to something that follows. Then, of course, you have the movie sequels, which follow the original film, as well as the Latin phrase non sequitur, which refers to a conclusion that does not logically follow from evidence or premise. So, to remember obsequious, highlight the S-E-Q-U in your vocabulary notebook and think of the keyword sequence. Maybe even draw a line of stick figures following the word obsequious. With this root and this visual, you won't forget the meaning of obsequious or the visual of fawning, servile lickspittles and toadies following you around, trying to curry your favor with insincere flattery. Now, the S-E-Q-U, S-E-C root is a fertile one and includes the following derived words, all sharing the core meaning of follow. Obsequious, sequence, non sequitur, sequel, consecutive, persecute. Second, when you're second in line, you follow the first person. Sect, a group of persons adhering to or following a doctrine or faith or leader. Consequence, and subsequent. You can write this root and all of these rich derived words down in your vocabulary notebook next to the word obsequious. So what do obsequious sycophants do? They might wheedle you into doing things or wheedle you out of doing things with their blandishments. Wheedle and blandishments are our next two target words. Wheedle is a verb that means to attempt to persuade with beguiling flattery and smooth talking. Synonyms for wheedle are cajole and coax. Now, I think that wheedle is one of those great underused words in English. It's a relatively short word that doesn't sound too fancy, but it really packs a punch. It's a word many of us may know when we hear or read it, but may not use enough in our expressive language, in conversation, or writing. But when you use it correctly, folks know what you're saying. I mean, think of all the times in your life when someone's tried to wheedle you into buying something that you didn't really want or need. For only $9.99 more, Mr. Flanagan, you can get 3 additional pot holders and a beer coolie with a photograph of yourself on it. Now, make a personal connection to wheedle. When was the last time someone tried to wheedle you into something or out of something? Write this personal experience in your vocabulary notebook next to wheedle. Also, write down wheedle's collocates, into and out of. Now, it's not only sycophants and suck-ups who might try and wheedle you. Think of snake oil salesmen, charlatans, hucksters, and mountebanks. All those slick-talking flim-flammers we met in our lecture on liars, cheaters, and swindlers. So let's try wheedle out. All it took was a few crocodile tears, a sob story, and compliments about him being the best dad in the world, and his teenage daughter had wheedled him out of his new Porsche 911 for the weekend. Blandishment, our next target word, is a noun referring to flattery that is designed to persuade a listener to do something. You'll usually see it used in its plural form as blandishments. The young rock star was blind to the outrageous blandishments of his entourage, even believing their ridiculous comments about him being the next Bob Dylan. They wheedled him out of millions, getting him to pay for limos, private jets, and epic parties on mammoth yachts. By the end of the year, he was dead broke. So to remember blandishment in your vocabulary notebook next to the word, write down some outrageous flattery you might have used in your life to try and get something. Or write down some flattery that was used on you. Okay, we've been talking about insincere people, sycophants, who give insincere flattery, blandishments. A related adjective in this general category of insincerity is unctuous, our next target word. Unctuous is an adjective that means characterized by affected, exaggerated, or insincere earnestness. An unctuous used car salesman is oily, slick, and smooth-talking. He's insincere in a greasy sort of way. Unctuous people are so obviously insincere in their praise and flattery that they're unpleasant and not trustworthy. You know the type. They're so slick, so oily, that after interacting with them, you want to go home and take a shower. In fact, unctuous and oily go together. Unctuous comes from the Latin unctus, meaning anointed with oil. Thus, the link with oily. Now, my dad has always linked the word unctuous with that golden line written by the American songwriter Alan J. Lerner from the musical My Fair Lady, describing an unctuous character. Oozing charm from every pore, he oiled his way across the floor. If there's a better description of unctuous, I haven't read it. A wonderful synonym for unctuous that's a little shorter and more down to earth, that hits you right in the gut, is smarmy. The smarmy aide thought his constant blandishments would butter up the congressman and eventually lead to a congressional appointment. Okay, let's review our falsely humble and insincere suck-up words. Sycophant, obsequious, wheedle, blandishments, and unctuous using the definition word game. I'll provide you the definition, and you provide the associated word. Okay, here we go. First definition. This word is a verb meaning to coax or cajole someone into or out of something, to try and persuade them with smooth talking and flattery. A telemarketer or a used car salesman trying to coax you into buying something you don't want is doing this to you. Answer, wheedle. Okay, second definition. This is another word for the grovelers, bootlickers, lickspittles, and toadies who use insincere flattery to persuade and influence those with power. These are the people at your office who shamelessly suck up to the boss for a promotion. What do you call these people? Answer, sycophants. Third definition. This word is an adjective used to describe people who are servile and fawning, overly deferential in order to curry favor. The root in this word actually means follow and is related to the words sequence, non sequitur, and sect. Answer, obsequious. Okay, we're at the fourth definition. This word is another adjective meaning too smooth, too slick, insincere in an oily sort of way. It's the stereotypical used car salesman. Answer, unctuous. Okay, fifth definition. What noun would you use for the type of flattery a student uses to get an A in a teacher's class? Answer, blandishments. And that ends today's lecture. And now, I'm sure you can't wait to go right home, take a long hot shower, and wash off the memories of the unctuous salesman, the groveling smarmy sycophants, and the bombastic, bloviating blowhards you met today. And I sincerely hope you don't bump into any bumptious drivers on the way home. Take care.
Lecture 13, High Frequency Greek and Latin Roots.
In her excellent book, The Greek and Latin Roots of English, Tamara Green tells of a popular rhyme weary Latin students recite. Latin is a dead language, as you can plainly see. It killed off all the Romans, and now it's killing me. While this little ditty makes us smile, it raises an important question. Is Latin truly dead? I mean, if no one speaks Latin today, why bother studying it? Well, as you know by now, my answer is that Latin and ancient Greek are not dead, but are vitally alive in English and in many other languages. Now, most of us don't study Greek and Latin affixes and roots, so we can read the Odyssey and the Aeneid in the original. We study Latin and Greek so we can improve our English. And remember, approximately 70% of English vocabulary contains Latin or Greek affixes or roots. And that's why we focus so much in this course on the morphology of the vocabulary words. Those affixes and roots can be our memory hook back to our words' meaning. So, the purpose of today's lecture is to explore some high-utility Latin and Greek affixes and roots that are not covered in depth in our other lectures. And just as importantly, we'll also explore how these prefixes, affixes, and roots combine to form words. And we'll learn a few more great target vocabulary words along the way. Now, for today's lecture, I'm particularly indebted to my co-authors on Vocabulary Their Way, Shane Templeton, Donald Baer, Marcia Invernizzi, Francine Johnston, Diana Townsend, Lori Hellman, and Tisha Hayes. These literacy scholars have become my beloved colleagues, from whom I've learned so much. So let's start with a very useful Greek prefix that puts our best foot forward. The prefix is spelled EU, pronounced U, and it means good, well, or pleasant. Now think of the word eulogy, which combines the Greek prefix eu with the Greek noun logos, meaning word. So, If you offer a eulogy at someone's funeral, you speak well of them. You offer good words about their life. Now, other English words that use this you prefix include euphemism, which is the use of a more pleasant word in place of a word that seems overly blunt or harsh, and euphonious, which refers to a pleasant sound. And note the P-H-O-N root in euphonious, which relates to sound. And here are two you words that spark debate. First is the word eugenics, which in Greek literally means good birth. Eugenics refers to the idea that you can improve the human race through selective breeding. And at the other end of life's spectrum is the noun euthanasia, which incorporates the prefix eu with the Greek noun thanatos, meaning death. So, euthanasia literally means a good or pleasant death. And of course, it's used to refer to mercy killing, a painless putting to death. All right, let's turn now from Greek to two high-frequency Latin prefixes. Now, we may touch on these in other lectures, but let's make sure that we know them well by exploring them more formally right here. So what do you think the Latin prefix dis means? Well, dis can mean not, and it can also mean opposite, or apart, or away. Disagree, our key word for dis, is not to agree. And I'd like you to note the word discard, literally to throw a card away during a card game. Now, I like the word discard because it reminds us that dis doesn't just mean not. Dis also can mean apart or away. Okay, that's dis. For our second Latin prefix, what does the in incorrect mean? In is another prefix that means not or without. So, incorrect means not correct. Dis and in, two prefixes that can mean not. Now, write these two prefixes down in your vocabulary notebook in the affixes and root section in the back, along with our key words. As you come across other, more sophisticated vocabulary words that include these prefixes, you might want to record them here. Now, you may be thinking, that's great, Kevin, but how can these relatively straightforward, common prefixes help me with more sophisticated vocabulary? Well, listen to these next two vocabulary words in which the prefix in plays an important role. And note how not is an important part of their definitions. First word, ineluctable. What do you think ineluctable means? It means not capable of being avoided, like your ineluctable destiny. And ineffable, not capable of being described in words, as in ineffable happiness. Now, let's take the dis prefix out for a test drive with another great word, disabile, our first target word today. In particular, let's see if dis can help us remember disabile, a word we borrowed from the French and never gave back. Now, what do you think disabile means? Disabile is a noun referring to the state of being dressed in a very casual or even careless, disheveled, and disorderly style. Disabile, disheveled and disorderly. Sounds like Felix Unger from The Odd Couple, doesn't it? Sloppy and casual. All right, let's put disabile in context. The absent-minded professor was completely unaware of his disabile, chalk on his rumpled clothes and all, as he solved math problems on the blackboard. Now, I'm often in disabile on early Saturday mornings when I have to run my kids to some activity, like early morning soccer practice. I haven't showered or shaved, and I've only had time to throw on an old, wrinkled pair of jeans and a sweatshirt. All right, let's make a personal connection. Think of a time you've been in disabile. Perhaps you were running late somewhere and didn't have time to spruce up. Or perhaps you know someone who was always a bit disheveled and unkempt. So, how can we remember dishabille? What word parts pop out at you? Yeah, there's that dis prefix, meaning not at the beginning. And what other word do you already know that looks like the second part of dishabille, the abille? How about the word habit? And a quick look into the etymology of dishabille lets us know that the habile comes from the French habiller, to dress. So literally, dishabille would mean not dressed. And in fact, the original déshabillé meant not fully dressed or scantily clothed. Now for our current English meaning of disheveled or casually or carelessly attired, let's make a different connection. Because listen to this, folks. Habile is related to the noun habit, as in the clothing worn by religious and clerical orders. Think of a nun's habit. So in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the dis, meaning not, and the H-A-B-I in habile and relate it to habit. And you could write, a nun who is often in dishabille is not in the habit of wearing her habit properly. It's wrinkled and it's in disarray. Visualize a disheveled-looking nun, perhaps Julie Andrews playing Sister Maria from The Sound of Music, as usual running late to prayers and in disarray, sprinting back to the abbey, disheveled and in dishabille. As the bells are tolling and you hear in the background, how do you solve a problem like Maria? How's that for a visual for dishabille? Now, before we move on to some more high-utility prefixes, I want you to remember the dis in dishabille as an object lesson. That high-utility prefix dis gives you a powerful hook to help you remember that a big part of this word's meaning is not. So someone who is in dishabille is not dressed formally. They are disheveled and a bit sloppy. Knowledge of relatively frequent prefixes like dis can be a great help in learning relatively infrequent, sophisticated vocabulary words like dishabille. So don't just think of today's lecture as a list of prefixes and roots that you have to memorize. Think of this lecture as giving you the tools to turn on your morphological radar. Now, what's morphological radar? Well, radar helps us detect things we might not be able to see easily, right? So, morphological radar is like our Latin and Greek early warning detection system. It helps us to identify Latin and Greek word parts, and that can help us sort out and store the meanings of unfamiliar words. And when you start looking at words this way, with your morphological radar turned on, you won't be able to stop. As one of my own students said, after having learned to look at words this way, I can't help it. I see roots everywhere now. Okay, let's move on from you, dis, and in to three more high-utility prefixes, pre, post, and another dis prefix. So, we just examined a Latin dis prefix. Now let's briefly examine a Greek dis prefix, spelled D-Y-S. They both carry a negative connotation. But whereas the Latin dis means not, or opposite or apart, the Greek prefix dys means bad, abnormal, or difficult. In words like dysfunctional, dysentery, and dystopia, which refers to a bad place. Another word that uses this Greek prefix is dyslexia, which refers to a biologically based difficulty in reading. Okay, our next high utility prefixes are pre and post. The prefix pre is from the Latin preposition pri, which means before. Think of the word preview, to view before. And think of pre-game speeches, premature and pretests, or even the word prefix. And as for post, it's from the Latin preposition post, meaning after. As in post-mortem, after death, and post-game, after the game. Now you already know these prefixes, but when you learn a new word, are you on the lookout for these prefixes? In other words, do you have your morphological radar turned on? For example, let's take our next target word, prescient. Now, you've probably heard or read prescient before, but what do you think it means? Do you think prescient means A, acutely aware of your surroundings so that you are unlikely to be surprised, or B, having foresight? If you answer B, having foresight, you're right. Prescient is an adjective meaning perceiving the significance of events before they happen. Now, this is a wonderfully useful word that I don't think we use enough. Let's listen to prescient in context. The prescient economist predicted the stock market collapse well before anyone else. Now, you may not hear the pre in prescient because the sound changes from pre to pre, but the spelling of pre does not change. There's that spelling meaning connection again. So in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the pre, meaning before, in prescient. And highlight the S-C-I-E-N and connect it to the related word, science. And what's science? It's knowledge that has been acquired. So prescient literally means having knowledge beforehand. And make a personal connection to prescient. Do you know someone who always seems to know things beforehand? Who seems to have foresight? Write their names down as an example of prescient. And one thing that I'm pretty good at is predicting what's going to happen next in a movie. I can usually predict who the bad guy is in a mystery before others. And my family hates it when I blurt my prescient predictions out loud, because most of the time, I'm right. I mean, if only I could think of a way to make money off my prescient movie predictions. Okay, now let's move from prefixes to roots. Now remember that roots are meaning parts that form the core of a word's meaning, but they cannot stand alone like base words. We'll explore four high-utility roots from Greek and Latin: man, umbra, tract, and therm. Okay, for our first target root today, see if you can find the common root and the common meaning in the following three words: manufacture, manual, and manacle. What common root do they all share? What common meaning do they all share? Well, before the Industrial Revolution, when you manufactured something, you usually did it manually. And while you manually manufactured, hopefully you didn't have manacles on your what? Your hands. And that brings us to our first target root, man, M-A-N, which comes from the Latin noun manus, meaning hand. Our key word for this root will be manicure. And when you get a manicure, a professional is taking care of your fingernails and your hands. So in your vocabulary notebook, write manicure down as your keyword for man. Also, draw a picture of a hand to help you remember that man means hand. Now, other derived words for man include manufacture, literally made by hand, manual, done with or pertaining to the hands, manipulate, to operate with the hands, manacle, handcuffs, manuscript. Now, script means to write. So a manuscript is a text written by hand. And here's a man word you may not be as familiar with: manumit. Let's make manumit our next target word. Now, what do you think manumit means? Many folks I've worked with have seen manumit before, but aren't sure of its meaning. So I'll give you a historical hint. Manumit was more likely to be used in the 1850s and the 1860s than it is today. So what was going on at that time in American history? Manumit is a verb meaning to release from slavery or servitude. And it comes from two Latin roots. Now, you already know man meaning hand. And mit is from the Latin verb mitto, meaning to send, let go, release. So think of the hand in the sense of the power of the master who releases their hands, their power, and sets an enslaved person free. That is a powerful visual for this historically important word. Now, to remember this word, in your vocabulary notebook, draw a picture of an open hand and write, let go with the hand to remember this word. You'll also encounter the noun form of this verb, manumission, meaning the act of setting someone free. And its synonym, emancipation, also includes this man root. And let's end this root with something a bit smelly, manure. What does manure, the excrement, especially of animals, used as a fertilizer, have to do with hands? I mean, imagine getting your hands in manure. Isn't that the last word you want to associate with manure? But manure is related to hands. And here's how. Manure as a verb came into English in approximately 1400, meaning to cultivate the land, from the French. And how did medieval farmers cultivate their lands? With their hands. Which brings us back to the meaning of the old French word from which manure came, to work with the hands, cultivate. Now, a big part of working in the earth was fertilizing it, putting dung on the soil, which led to the current noun, manure, meaning dung spread as fertilizer. So, from cultivating the soil with your hands, to spreading fertilizer, to the fertilizer itself. How's that for a handy and smelly and fertile etymological story? All right, for our next target root, let's move from hands to something we've all carried in our hands, an umbrella. Now, what do you use an umbrella for? What was the original purpose of an umbrella? If you said to protect yourself from the rain, you are not correct. Actually, an umbrella's original purpose was to protect one from the sun. Yes, I said sun. In terms of etymology, umbrella actually means little shadow and comes to English through Italian from the Latin noun umbra, meaning shade or shadow. So think of the ancient Romans in their sunny Mediterranean climate carrying umbrellas to protect themselves from the sun by providing a little shadow for themselves. And this is what our next target root umbra, U-M-B-R, means, shade or shadow. So in your vocabulary notebook, write the word umbrella as your key word for this umbra root, meaning shade or shadow. Draw a picture of an umbrella with a picture of the sun and write, an umbrella shaded the Romans from the sun. So what are some other words you already know that are derived from umbra? Well, do you remember the word umbra from your astronomy class back in high school? The umbra is a region of complete shadow resulting from a total obstruction of light. And the penumbra is the partial shadow outside of that complete shadow. And sombrero is related to umbra. But what does a sombrero do? It is a broad-brimmed hat that shades one from the sun. And you've heard the phrase to take umbrage at, which means to take offense. Yes, this is also related. As noted in John Ayto's Dictionary of Word Origins, the expression take umbrage or take offense arises from a metaphorical extension of shadow to suspicion. I mean, suspicious statements and people are shady, aren't they? And when someone makes a statement that we suspect is insulting, we take umbrage. So when umbrellas made their way to England, they started to be used for what? The rainy English climate. Women started using umbrellas in England about 1700, and men approximately 50 years later. That's why we think of umbrellas today as protecting from rain. And even the word somber is related to umbra. A somber affair like a funeral can be grave, gloomy, and dark, just like a shadow. Okay. Let's finish our treatment of the umbra root with a very literary target word that English professors love to use, and you can use at your next book club meeting to impress your friends. Adumbrate. Now notice the U-M-B-R in the middle of adumbrate. Adumbrate is a verb that has two primary meanings you'll encounter. First, to give a sketchy outline of, to suggest, disclose, or outline partially. When you give a vague outline of something, what are you doing? You're providing a vague shadow cast by the thing itself. So here's an example of this sense of adumbrate in context. When quizzed by the English teacher, the student was able to briefly adumbrate the major themes in the novel. Now you'll also see adumbrate used in its second sense of to foreshadow vaguely, to intimate, as in the following sentence. The first scene in the play, where she notices the new buds on the trees, adumbrates her spiritual rebirth in the second scene. Okay, so, in your vocabulary notebook, to remember adumbrate, write down that when you adumbrate, you either foreshadow something to come, or you provide a brief shadowy outline of something. Okay, let's move from shadows to something that is a bit more concrete for our third target word today, tract. Now, do you think tract means A, push, or B, pull? Well, listen to these words to see if they will help. Tractor, traction, extract, retract. So if you said that tract means B, pull, you're correct. The root tract comes from the Latin verb traho, which means to drag, pull, draw, or haul. And our key word for tract will be, what else? A tractor. What do tractors do? They pull things. Other words derived from tract include distract. Well, dis means apart, so when you're distracted, you're pulled apart or away from something. And attract. The AT is a variant spelling of the Latin preposition AD, meaning to. So when two people are attracted, they are pulled to each other. And extract, X, to pull out. And after an accident, you might be put in traction, in which case your bones or your muscles are being pulled. And you've probably also heard of folks in politics using traction in the figurative sense of, this idea is starting to get traction with the electorate. And what's an intractable problem? It's one that is not able to be pulled. You can't move it. Wow, that tract root sure has a lot of pull. Okay, let's finish today's lecture by going back in history to ancient Greece. In 480 BCE, Xerxes the Great, ruler of the Persian Empire, is invading Greece with his massive army, which according to modern estimates may have numbered approximately 100,000 men. Now, if you've read Frank Miller's graphic novel, 300, or seen Zack Snyder's movie of the same name based on it, you may be familiar with this story. Now, as you would imagine, there's great fear and anxiety running throughout Greece. A number of Greek city-states have decided to put their rivalries aside and form an alliance to repel the invading Persians. And to face the enormous Persian army, the Greeks made a strategically astute decision. They planned to defend the narrow coastal pass of Thermopylae, which means the Hot Gates, a reference to its hot sulfur springs there. Now, of all the Greeks, the Spartans were known as the fiercest and best-trained warriors. So it was no surprise that King Leonidas and his Spartans ended up leading the Greek allied army against the Persians. And Leonidas chose 300 of his best Spartan soldiers to make the stand at Thermopylae. And these 300 warriors were joined by approximately 6,000 soldiers from other Greek cities. Fewer than 7,000 against 100,000. Now, before the Battle of Thermopylae began, Xerxes attempted to negotiate with the Spartans, promising them their freedom and better land if they submitted. And when Leonidas refused these terms, Xerxes demanded that the Greeks hand over your arms. And Leonidas's famously terse reply has echoed down the ages. Come and take them. Boy, that was pretty bold, huh? Those Spartans sure had a knack for the pithy comeback. Now, leading up to the battle, one of Xerxes' scouts found that the pass at Thermopylae was blocked by a wall with the 300 Spartans out front, exercising and combing their hair. However, Xerxes was warned not to take the Spartans lightly, for this is how they prepare for battle. So, the Persians attack. And although they greatly outnumber the Greeks, they can't take advantage of their overwhelming numbers because of the narrow pass. And in addition, the longer spears of the Spartans are particularly deadly in this narrow space. So wave after wave of attacking Persians are repulsed as the Spartans rotate their troops, some holding the front line, while others rested. The Greeks had planned extremely well. And the Spartans also used a clever ruse. They feign retreat, inducing the Persians to race after them. And then they suddenly turn and kill the attacking enemy in their confusion. However, eventually the tide turns. Ephialtes, a Greek trader with the hopes of being rewarded by the Persians, comes to Xerxes and shows the Persians another path that winds through the mountains and enables the Persians to outflank the Greek army. And when Leonidas realizes his dire situation, he decides to stay and fight to the death with his 300 Spartans as the Greek rear guard. This will allow the rest of the Greek army to retreat in safety so they can fight another day. So, the Spartans fought to the last. When their weapons broke, they fought with their hands and their teeth, and eventually they were overrun. But their courage set an example for the rest of Greece. So this courageous account from history leads us to our last route today. Let's take another look at the word Thermopylae again. Do you notice any word part that pops out at you? Now here's a hint. Remember, Thermopylae means the hot gates. That's right. Therm or thermo is a Greek root meaning heat or temperature. Now we're going to have two key words for this root to help us remember its two meanings, heat and temperature. Thermal will be one of our key words. Thermal underwear keeps you nice and toasty, almost hot. And thermometer will be our other key word. What do thermometers measure? They measure temperature. So, thermo means heat or temperature. Write the meaning and the keywords down in your vocabulary notebook. Now here are some other therm words. Hypothermia. Hypo is a Greek preposition that means below. So hypothermia is abnormally low body temperature. And of course the opposite of hypothermia is hyperthermia. The Greek preposition hyper means over or beyond. Think of the words hyperactive and hyperbole. Another important therm word is thermodynamics, the branch of physics dealing with the relationship between heat and other forms of energy. And then there's geothermal, pertaining to heat generated in the Earth's interior. And thermos, of course. And what about BTU, British Thermal Unit? That's the amount of heat required to raise 1 pound of water 1 degree Fahrenheit. That is one hot root. So now, as we approach the end of this lecture, I'd like you to remember the most important point about affixes and roots. Don't feel you have to memorize lots of affixes and roots right away. What's most important to me is that you turn on your morphological radar, that you start looking for affixes and roots in the words you encounter and learn. You can always look up the meaning of a prefix or root later to help you remember the word's meaning. But you won't know what to look up if you don't know what to start looking for in these words in the first place. So, as we continue to learn new target words in this course, see if you can identify the affixes and roots as we discuss them. And before long, you'll start looking at words in an entirely new way. And just like my student, you'll start seeing affixes and roots everywhere, and you just won't be able to stop.
Lecture 14, Words Relating to Belief and Trust.
Welcome back. To start today's lecture, ask yourself this question. Is there someone in your life you have complete trust in? Someone you can always count on? Maybe it's your best friend, your brother or your sister, or your husband or wife. And how about the opposite? Someone you'd only trust as far as you could throw them. Someone who's deceitful and treacherous. Friedrich Nietzsche, the 19th century German philosopher, once said, "I'm not upset that you lied to me. I'm upset that from now on, I can't believe you." Nietzsche's quote shows just how closely trust and belief, the two themes of today's lecture, are tied together. Now, English has a number of precise and powerful words to describe different facets of trust and belief. As we explore vocabulary centering on these themes, be on the lookout for two questions that we'll be answering today. One, what's an apostate, and is it related to an apostle? And what's the difference between being equivocal, ambiguous, and ambivalent? Okay, let's get started. Our first set of four words deals with belief, including a type of arrogant self-belief. For our first target word, picture yourself in this scenario. You're a college freshman. It's the first day of your first class, Political Science 101, and you're quaking in your boots. Professor Gnosis has a reputation for being the most intimidating, arrogant, know-it-all professor on campus. And 5 minutes into the lecture, you know exactly why. He begins by making a series of polarizing statements that aren't based on any facts at all. And what's worse, he's speaking in the most arrogant, pompous, condescending manner you can imagine. What a jerk. You keep your head down and your mouth shut, furiously scribbling notes and hoping to stay under his radar. But one particularly brave and naive soul tentatively raises her hand and dares to question the great man. Instead of answering, Professor Gnosis launches into a tirade of epic proportions, verbally bashing the student's thinking, unwilling and unable to see anyone else's viewpoint but his own. This opinionated know-it-all is being dogmatic, our first target word. Dogmatic is an adjective that means characterized by an authoritative, arrogant assertion of unproven ideas. Dogmatic can describe someone who adheres to one way and one way only, someone who's narrow-minded, not open-minded. Remember, for dogmatic people, it's their way or the highway. Okay, here's dogmatic in context. The company's dogmatic adherence to their way of doing business, because that's the way it was always done, led them down the path to eventual bankruptcy. Synonyms and related words for dogmatic include authoritarian and imperious. And one that I really like is doctrinaire. Use doctrinaire if you want to emphasize someone stubbornly adhering to a doctrine or theory, even if it's not practical. Use imperious if you want to emphasize someone's haughty, overbearing manner. And if you're just hanging out with a friend who's being a bit dogmatic, you can still call them out using more informal terms like pushy, opinionated, one-sided, and narrow-minded. Now, the noun form of dogmatic is dogma, which means doctrines and beliefs relating to morality and faith. But, and here's the interesting part, the original Greek word dogma meant an opinion, tenet, or literally, that which one thinks is true. So, this original meaning of dogma, an opinion, what one thinks is true, not proven fact, is closer to what dogmatic means today, arrogantly opinionated. So, do you know someone who's extremely opinionated and arrogant? You know who I'm talking about, the pompous know-it-all at school, at work, or in your neighborhood. He can't see anyone else's viewpoint but his own. He stubbornly sticks to his set of opinions without any supporting evidence. In a word, he's dogmatic. So to help you remember this word, make a personal connection and write this person's name down in your notebook next to dogmatic. And the next time you bump into this overbearing, doctrinaire individual, make a quick getaway, or you might be subjected to hours and hours of our next target word. Dogmatic people are so annoying and overbearing that if you do run into one at the next shindig, they often clear the room out pretty quickly. However, if you're unlucky and get cornered by a dogmatic know-it-all and you can't slip away, English has the perfect word to describe what you're in for. Dogmatic people pontificate, our next target word. Pontificate is a verb that means to speak or express opinions in a pompous or dogmatic way. If you say that someone's pontificating, You mean that he or she is speaking in a patronizing and supercilious manner, especially at some length. You'd better make yourself comfortable, because you might be there for quite a while. Let's put pontificate in context. My high and mighty roommate never misses a chance to pontificate, regardless of whether she knows anything about the topic. Or, political pundits love to pontificate on talk shows. However, these talking heads rarely seem to offer any hard evidence to back up their partisan claims. Now, what word do you already know that looks like it's related to pontificate? A word associated with religion. If you said pontiff, you're right. Pontiff can refer to a high priest, a bishop, or the Roman Catholic Pope. Pontificate can also mean to perform the duties of a pontiff. To remember this word, you might want to visualize a dogmatic pontiff pompously pontificating from the pulpit. See if you can quietly slip out of the back of the church during that sermon. You might also want to make a personal connection. Remember that dogmatic person that you made a connection to earlier? Make a note that this dogmatic person pontificates. Visualize this know-it-all pontificating while everyone rolls their eyes and skedaddles. And remember, making connections between related words like dogmatic and pontificate is one of the most powerful ways to strengthen and broaden your vocabulary knowledge. Okay, let's move on from dogma and pontificate to our next target word, a word that refers to a certain type of believer. Well, kind of a believer. For this word, imagine that you've been a liberal Democrat your entire life. And then suddenly you make a 180-degree turn, switch parties, and become a staunch, ultra-conservative Republican. You tear down your Make Love, Not War poster and hang up photographs of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher above your bed. What would your liberal friends call you? Now, disregarding the words that I can't use in this course, some of your liberal-leaning friends might call you a traitor or turncoat, but the ones with a rich, expressive vocabulary who took this course might call you our third target word, an apostate. Apostate is a noun referring to someone who abandons his or her religion, political beliefs, principles, or cause. Let's put apostate in context. The extremist group labeled any member who quit as an apostate deserving of death. Or you might hear the noun form of apostate, apostasy, the abandonment of one's beliefs. As in, when he questioned the minister in front of the congregation, he was accused of apostasy and told to leave. Now, synonyms and related words for apostate include backslider, defector, deserter, renegade, heretic, and turncoat. Definitely not terms of endearment. Now, apostate comes from the Greek prefix apo, meaning away from, and the Greek verb stenai, meaning to stand. So, an apostate stands away from his or her beliefs. That etymology gives us a great visual mnemonic. To remember this word, you could write the word belief on one side of the page in your vocabulary notebook and sketch a stick figure on the other side, showing the distance between an apostate and his or her former beliefs. Make a personal connection to apostate. Think of someone you've known, perhaps yourself, who might have switched his or her beliefs. Perhaps due to a particular experience, like going off to college, traveling the world, or working in a certain job. Write this person's name down in your vocabulary notebook. Now, before we move on, you might be wondering, is apostate related to apostle? Part of it is. According to John Ayto's outstanding resource, Dictionary of Word Origins, the word apostle was borrowed from Greek into Latin, and then into Old English, and it meant messenger. Apostle and apostate both share the Greek prefix apo, meaning away from. However, the second word part of apostle came from the Greek verb stelein, meaning to send. So an apostle is a messenger sent away to spread the word, whereas an apostate stands away from his former beliefs. Our fourth and final target word in this first part of our lecture is agitprop. To set this up, picture yourself out in the town with your friends. You've decided to go to the opening night of a play at a very trendy theater. At first, you're enjoying it, but by the second act, it's becoming increasingly apparent that the play's being used merely as a vehicle to push the writer's extreme political agenda, and it's ruining the play. You're getting agitated at what you consider such blatant propaganda. So much so that you rise